Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an X-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Ed.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Sharon.
Hey.
Hey.
How are we? Happy New Year to our listeners and happy Christmas to our listeners.
Yes, yeah, we took a bit of a break.
Yeah.
But we're back.
We are. We have returned somewhat. Yes. Rejuvenated, yeah. Also having gone through life, but somewhat rejuvenated.
Yeah, as rejuvenated as one can be in the current state of affairs, I would say.
And in your mid to late 30s, yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me, mid to late 20s, I'm going to go with.
Of course,
20.
Yeah. Teens.
Sure.
Yes,
teenager. Sure. If you're a teenager, there's a lot wrong.
but yeah, good. How are you?
All good. Glad to see you too.
Yes.
See your lovely faces.
Yes. It has been, I mean, it feels like and has been quite a while.
It's been about a month.
Yeah. I think it might. Yeah. I would say.
Not far off.
The longest I've gone without seeing you since early 2020.
Yeah.
It was last year, anyway.
Gosh. Right. So, anyway, we're here.
We're talking about the episode. This is season 4, episode 12, Sharp Relief. What do we think of this episode first?
Overall, I thought it was an episode of threads as opposed to a solid episode on its own.
Yes.
If that makes sense?
Yeah, definitely. It felt very, you know, it felt very separated and not... It didn't feel very ER-y. I don't know if that's because Carol was out of the ER and Carter was out of the ER and there was no real... It didn't feel like there was a case in the same way as...
No, I know what you mean.
I think because it was Anspar's son is in there and that became part of the kind of the story, it felt more... It just felt like very like, here's a bit about this person, here's a bit about... It felt fragmented in some way, which isn't always a bad thing, but...
Yeah.
I prefer the ones where it's like we're in the ER and they're all working together and it just felt a bit too separate for me.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough.
I think that's absolutely fair. I think lots of storylines get furthered.
Yes.
But it's definitely it's not one of those, oh, do you remember this episode? Not really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's something about, you know, when they wheel somebody in, like if they do all the separate storylines, but they have a moment where they wheel somebody in and surgery has to come down and we have one of those, you know, the cameras going around the room and Carter's here and Green's there. It didn't have one of those in the same way. And I think if it had had that, I probably wouldn't have noticed as much, but because it didn't feel like they were all together in a room kind of shouting above each other, I was a bit like, oh.
No, I think that's fair enough. And
I think the closest we get... maybe we should get into the episode.
Let's do that.
Right. We start off with Doug and Carol in the locker room.
Oh, now this storyline is painful for me, I have to say.
Should we rip the band-aid off and just do this one first?
I mean, it starts out so sweetly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Carol, you know, we have this, you know, Doug is basically, they're both in the doctor's lounge. Doug is signing off for the evening. Carol's coming in, so we know they're obviously on, you know, different shifts and different world. Carol's on another paramedic run. Like, if there is anybody who does not need another paramedic run, it's Carol. I feel like she's the only person who seems to go.
I was kind of thinking that, like, you know, when was the last time Connie went in a paramedic run? Yeah. You know, when was the last time Helle was in the back of a ambulance? And... Right, so my really harsh... So this is my thing for 2020, is that I'm going to be really harsh on ER. I just kind of felt... Yeah, so time travel. Time travel is a thing. Because actually, I did feel with this storyline, I've been there, done that.
Oh.
I have to say, I got Shep vibes. Now, not that he was anything like Shep, because he wasn't, but I just thought, are we doing this again? Can Carol not go near an ambulance and not
fall in? Yeah, this is the thing. Yeah. That's what it exactly that. Have you got no other ideas? Is it just that's where, is there something about ambulances that gets her hot and bothered and running to the first man she can see on them? Because
it's, yeah, it's wounded men in ambulances.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, well, we get this whole, and this is why I find this storyline tough, because Doug is definitely at a place where he is ready for everything and he knows that she is the one, all that stuff, and she's not there at all. So we get that little kind of flavor of that again in this episode, this moment in this opening episode, because opening scene, because he says to her, like, I want you to say it first, the words you never say.
Oh, that was,
and I was like, so for me, as much as like I'm not into what Carol does in this episode, I also feel very much like, what is wrong with Doug? Like, at no point has she said she really, all, if you've listened to her, you know, you would know she doesn't want to get married. That's the thing I'm getting off her. And he just seems to be feeling insecure for whatever reason and is really pushing that on her. And maybe it's making her pull away. But then this whole thing, this, you say it first about I love you.
It felt really codependent, didn't it?
Yeah.
It felt really kind of...
It was, I don't, weird is too reductive a word, but I got just a weird vibe off Carol and Doug this week that I don't think there was, we have got a little bit of Carol's been more hesitant than Doug has been. So we have got that.
Yeah.
But then you had that scene in Fathers and Sons where these guys are clearly endgame.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Carol is like, oh, actually, I'm not sure, and we're moving too fast. And it just felt like... spoiler for Game of Thrones. It felt like Game of Thrones Season 8. I'm not necessarily sad with what happened. They just didn't give us the lead-in to it.
Yeah,
and suddenly it was like this. It was like, okay.
I'm with you, because I feel really much, I feel really like they were on one track, and then they went, oh, we don't want these two to be together yet, because we're getting some mileage out of kind of this relationship, and if we just get them married off, we'll lose that. We better put something in the obstacle in the way. But then they haven't done it really that organically, I feel, because, like, as you say, you know, they really were end game and she really wanted to be with him, and they were all, it was all, and then all of a sudden she's turning around going, oh, I'm not sure I want to get married. And I thought, why, though, we haven't had the reasons, what is it that's going on for her? Could we see her outside and out and about a bit going, oh, you know, this is going well in my life, I didn't want to, I tried to be a doctor, but actually in the end decided, no, I like being a nurse. I don't know. Yeah, just some exploration elsewhere where we figure out why she feels like all of a sudden this is a rush, which we didn't get. We just got quick send an ambulance man in to distract her.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And yes, he's a lovely, handsome man, and that was grand. And
he's gorgeous.
But even in this, Greg Powell. Oh, Greg Powell. Yes. I mean, I like Greg Powell. Not a word against Greg Powell. We like Greg Powell a lot.
Yeah.
And also, that was all very, he was completely open with his intention. So Greg Powell is not a Shep.
Yeah.
But he's also, he's nothing other than a pretty face. That's how I felt he was portrayed in this episode. They tried to give him that moment when they walk into the apartment, and again it just felt hollow, because I just felt that they needed to get to the conversation where Carol reveals that she tried to take her life, and they have it, okay, but why use that particular storyline for that as well? And I'm not getting lost down my rabbit hole here, because we'll get to Mark and kind of that storyline, but I felt like this was a throwaway victim in that storyline.
Yes, like a device rather than a real...
Yeah, and this is a massive, important storyline in season four.
Which has been rumbling as well for the past, you know, we've seen it rumble and rumble. And I think I agree with you. I think it felt like we met Greg a while back. He was there, he was pretty. Then all of a sudden he comes back and they're trying to all of a sudden we learn all this stuff about him, and he's just very heavy in the episode. And we're like, it's like if they'd given us time to warm up to him, given us a few episodes, then done this for us to care about him.
Oh, it's developing a bit.
Yeah, rather than just, oh, I'm here and now all of a sudden I'm having a trauma about something. I felt a bit like, I haven't got time for your trauma. I've got all these other characters I actually care about.
Yeah, kind of.
In a mean way, like,
yeah,
you were, he was not developed enough for me. And he kind of, I mean, we see him at the firehouse as well, and he's all like, you know, the guy, Dwight, the other paramedic, is making some tofu stew or whatever. And he's being all like, you've got to be a real man. You've got to have meat. And
that bit was just annoying. I was like, are you a real American? I'm like, right, you're saying that to the white person versus the black person who's making the gumbo.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It just seemed like really...
Yeah, and also just this idea, and I really hate it when people go, well, this is what a real American is, or a real British person, real. Yeah. It's like, so what are you saying to all the vegans or the vegetarians or the... It just annoys me that there's this idea of what a real American should look like, and that should be eating meat and drinking beer, because that's where we get into the troubles we get into about identity and about what is American and what isn't. And I don't know, that made also then made me even more like, I'm not sure I'm that keen on you at the moment, because you kind of, he just felt very like, I'm a man. It was like, all right, we get it, you know, we get it, his Diet Coke man from the late 90s. That's what I don't know if it needed this extra push of kind of...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I like the fact that Doris called him out and said, you are a caveman.
Yeah, me too. So as you say, you know, so they get called out. They get called out to an apartment, and they go in, and it's a woman who we recognise. She's got whore, basically, again, written on her. She's an elderly woman, so we recognise that she's obviously a victim of this hideous rapist that's going around, but she's been quite violently beaten, which is an escalation, because all the, you know, the other women, that one woman had kind of come in and she'd been hurt a little bit, and she'd been, but
broken her arm, but he hadn't, like, as far as we know as an audience, this is the first death.
Exactly.
Now, it's hinted that no, there's other stuff going on, there's jurisdiction issues, you know, it's kind of you know, but as far as we have seen as an audience, this is the first case that leads to death. She survives long enough to get her to the ER, because we have to talk to Mark, because it's part of his storyline. But
And I think, so, you know, they come in and Greg is kind of freaking out, and none of us know why. And, you know, Carol basically in the end, kind of her and Doris have to take over, and they look after the lady, and they take her into the ER where she does pass away. And again, Greg is still acting very strangely. All the way through this as well, we've had Doug say to Carol as well in that first moment, you know, I want to meet you on Dearborn and Fifth or whatever it is. Yes. So they've got this plan to meet, and he's very much, it's a surprise. She doesn't like surprises. He won't tell her what it is. And so we have these two strands. She's supposed to meet Doug, but Greg is freaking out and upset. She also... You know, they find her purse, don't they? And they realize she has a cat, which makes them go back to the apartment, because they think, oh, somebody needs to feed the cat. And so they go back to the apartment where there are loads of people, you know, all the kind of police people
doing their
investigation. The CSI people, which is that what Powell was in other shows? Was he in one of those? He could have been right at home going, hang on, let me start.
It's like a taste for another career. I'm like, maybe I could do this bit.
Or maybe the CSI people saw him and got the idea for the show and then were like, we want you anyway. And that's where they have this moment on the roof where he explains why he got so affected. It's basically he's the one who found his mom, who committed suicide when he was younger, and it just brought a lot of those flashbacks. Again, I found this a bit tenuous, because I thought, you're a paramedic, surely this isn't the first body you've... The fact that he'd found the mom when he was like 9 or 10 or whatever, young.
Nothing happened in the meantime.
This is the first time he'd come across I don't know. It just felt the way he was acting was like he was shocked and hadn't been around this kind of a thing since, which I didn't believe as a paramedic again.
Maybe he's fairly new to it. This is his first one. I'm just there. I totally get where you're coming from. I'm just sort of providing a different viewpoint. But it does seem a bit
It just felt jarring to me. Like, yeah, people were like, oh, my, because when he said all about my mum, I thought, okay, maybe this happened like 5 years ago or something, or a couple of years ago. But when he was like, I was a kid, I was a bit like, okay, I'm not 100% bought into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's not, okay, I'm fine. Obviously, I'm fine with him having trauma. Good for me. No, but it's...
we'll allow him his trauma.
Yes. Delighted. Yeah. But yeah, again, it was... Yes, new character, have to get a little backstory, totally fine with that. But again, I think it just cycles back to, surely if, you know, he's confident enough that he's been a paramedic for long enough, that unfortunately the nature of the job is he's probably stumbled into a crime scene, he's probably had to, and then, I suppose though, maybe I'm being harsh because it's maybe a way of going, oh, this crime is so horrid. That, you know.
Yeah, maybe. So, he hasn't come across something this hideous in Chicago. Yeah. I mean, and then you know, because he's still obviously very angry at his mom, and he brings all that up and talks about how selfish she was. And obviously then Carol says, you know, basically does her usual kind of coming out of the fact that she also has been in that position. And they kind of have a discussion about that, and he's very apologetic about the fact that he was saying that, and they talk a little bit about it. And then he says that he wants to kiss her, and exactly what you're saying, Sean, like, he's very upfront, and at no point does she say, hang on a minute, mate, I've got somebody. Like, there is a long time between he says, I want to give you a kiss, and him actually coming up, and then he goes over very slowly. There's plenty of opportunity for her to stop him, is what I'm trying to get at, which he says- doesn't.
I did make a note of this line. If I look at you one more second, I'm going to have to kiss you. And like, if she wasn't with Doug, I would have been, yay, punch in the air because they're hot and all that kind of stuff. Not that she's making a difference, but it was a good line.
I thought
it
was weird.
It's a bit odd, but...
It'd be a good line if they were doing somewhere fun or somewhere sexy or... My mom died of suicide. Oh, I tried to commit suicide. I'm going to give you a kiss now.
That's what it was for me.
Yeah. Like, does that turn you on? Like, is that the thing? I'm going to have to always release trauma before anything happens between us? I don't know. I found it...
I'm not going to lie, Greg. That's going to take some time, some planning, you know, there's an awful lot of letters that need to be written. And I don't know, just for a kiss. It doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. I don't know. What it was for me is it just felt like a device. They needed something to split or give, you know, break whatever's happening between Carol and Doug, and this is what they did, and it just felt a bit too shallow for me. It just
like he wasn't really a character, he was just a way of
completely
getting her to confront her doubts,
like, yeah, and for them to go, oh, quick, we want to put a thing in the way of this couple, so let's, because we don't want them to get together too soon, because we might, it happens so much in stuff, you know, they go, oh shit, we've put the couple together too quickly, we need to bring something up, and I don't know, it just felt a bit like that for me. And so she kisses him, and then she goes home to Doug, who's been waiting for her, and Doug kind of is quite angry because he's been waiting for her and she hasn't kind of checked in with him, and she didn't meet him when they were supposed to have plans. And again, kids, you know, this is before phone, you know, mobile phones, so people weren't able to kind of just text if they're going to be late or...
That's actually quite funny. It's funny that you mentioned that, because this was obviously, I think it was 97, 98, and I was watching, a little while back, I was watching the original Scream movie from 1996.
Oh, nice.
With a friend of mine, and she had never seen any of the films.
No way! So, I love Scream.
Like, no, how do you go through life? But
how amazing to do that all over again, though. Well, not all over again, but to do that for the first time.
For the first time. And to the point where, like, something that we took totally for granted, because I saw it relatively soon after it came out, so it was still in the 90s that I saw it. Same. And there is a plot point where, Billy, spoilers, I guess, but anyway, has a cell phone, and that in itself is incriminating in 1996.
Yeah, because few people have it, and it means he could have made the call.
Exactly. And then, so my friend was just like, what's the issue? Like, oh yeah, no, in 1996, not everybody had a cell phone. It wasn't like, you know, kind of like surgically attached to the palm of your hand.
Yeah, the
as way phones it is. Generally are today, you know.
This, the thing I just wanted, sorry to segue and scream a little bit, but that must be so, like, I'm really glad I kind of saw it in the 90s because of all that. Like, I wonder how much of it, I just wonder how much of it holds up, because I think sometimes as well, you know, something really pushes and starts a genre that then gets replicated, gets bigger, grows.
Yeah.
And it becomes so normalized that you don't realize how cool it was at the time. Like, Scream really, they did so many things with Scream that other films had not done, and you know, they made it like as if Drew Barrymore was the head, the part of this film, and she was, you know, just all of that. And they kind of really took the, you know, really took films and the genre and tore it apart and kind of messed with it and all that stuff. And I think we've become so meta and self-referential now. I just wonder if watching it would have the same power if you watch it now with all the stuff we have in our lives to watching it then. Going, oh gosh, you know, wow, this is ripping everything apart. It's like The Matrix, you know, the first time people saw The Matrix was like, and then you watch, if you're coming of age now and you're watching it, action films and the way they shoot some stuff and all that kind of, you know, it was of its, you know, it was so amazing when they did that shot about, you know, when they could go down and they did that crazy shot of all slow motion of them bending backwards and all that stuff. So forward, you know, the first time anything like that's done. Now it's just the norm.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I just wonder, but that's just my own little.
But it is, it's funny when you think of, we will get back to VR eventually, but you know, it is funny when you think of just how monumental these things were at the time, which to be fair, ER was in its, in very much its own right. It kind of defined for a long time what a good, and I realize, you know, kind of not that other things aren't good, but what a good effectively soap opera serial could be and could be, you know, could be presented as. This, there was a lot of production value to this while also looking like they had just walked into a hospital and started filming.
Exactly. And I think that's what why I'm always kind of Mrs. This is the hill I will definitely die on, is everyone always talks about the West Wing, and I'm like, ER did it all first. And actually I was watching something of the West Wing people and they were all going, ER did it first, because what they did was they basically made little films every week. You know, that first episode was like a film, and it was nothing else was like that. You know, films were films and TV was TV, and I really believe that a lot of the stuff we have nowadays, a lot of the long form glossy dramas we have now, owes everything to things like ER, which went, we can do this up for TV, we can make this high stakes, we can shoot it in a really filmic way, we can come up with new things, the walk and talk, the, you know, all that stuff, we can do it all, but for a TV show. And I think that's why it was and is what it is, and why I think people still love it and all that. And actually somebody who worked on it, a few people who worked on it originally, then went on to do The West Wing, and that's why I think you know, it really does share kind of a lot of things with that. So at the ending we have Doug kind of walking out on Carol, which, you know, I kind of don't blame him. I guess we'll go quickly into Doug's story, because I think what's important here is why I think he's more upset than he might have been if it had just been any other days. So he's very excited because, you know, he says, oh, you've got to meet me. Later he meets
Mark in Doc Magoo's.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's where he basically pulls out the ring. So actually tonight he's going to surprise her with a wedding. I felt very mixed about this because I thought, I feel like when it's, she should know. You don't go, by the way, let's go get married.
Carol keeps falling into these situations where the man is the one who's dictating the pace of the relationship. Do you know what I mean? Like, Shep decided to move in, didn't he? He sort of was the first one to say, I love you. And what's his name?
Tag,
thank you.
Captain Beige.
Thank you, Captain Beige. That's why I couldn't remember his name, because he's Tag.
He's so beige.
Ugh. I know. But again, he decided the pace and she just went along for the ride. And the same thing's happening again, but she keeps having these, in order to get out of it, there has to be some big dramatic event. Do you know what I mean? That's how she gets out of...
Yeah, and I feel like maybe she needs to look at that with a therapist, because I think there's just... Is she not communicating? I mean, to be fair to her with this, though, she has said to Doug a number of times about the fact that she doesn't want to get married. You know, he's putting rings on, all that stuff. And that's why I was a bit, like, annoyed at Doug, because I thought, she has said a lot of times she doesn't want to get married, and you aren't really listening to her. It also felt very desperate on Doug's part. I felt more there was a sense of locking her down rather than it being like, because I think if you really want to spend your time and life with somebody and you love them and they say to you, I'm not ready, you would wait rather than go, you're not ready. I've booked the chapel. Like, I don't know. And a surprise chapel, she says to you, she doesn't like surprises. This isn't a small surprise, like, oh, surprise, I'm taking you for pizza tonight. This is a, by the way, we're going to get married, which to me is like...
I even if, say there hadn't been a kiss, say there hadn't been a ride along, I don't think it would have gone well anyway. As you say, she had been quite clear about the fact, no, don't want to do this, after he had gone and spoken to her mother, and he had pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think it's because, me give Doug a big cuddle. I love Doug. It's because he's still running off that. I messed up so badly before. Yes. I must show, I must show, I must show. It's like, slow down, because you're trying so hard to show that you are not being a part of things.
Exactly. You're not being a partner either. You know, you're not listening. You're not thinking, what's the pace? Maybe you should be going at the pace of the slowest person in the relationship rather than at yours. And also, I think there's something about him still grieving for his dad. And this, you know, if I marry Carol, who is the answer, the kind of the antidote to what my dad did and live how he lived his life, then I could escape that. You know, I just feel like there's still too much going on and he needs to take time. Although, I mean, how sweet is that scene where he's talking to Mark and he's like, I know this is who I want to marry. And it's all of that is very, very beautiful and very sweet, and very shocking to see of Doug. Because, you know, if we think back, you know, even a year ago, it's like, whoa. But we see, you know, he's matured and he's grown, not fully all the way there yet, but you know he has. So I think that's why it makes it really heartbreaking at the end, you know, because she doesn't know that was the plan, and she basically left him on the street. So you know, you're waiting for somebody, you've got this plan, the surprise, and you wait for them and then they come back. And also we have that scene where Mark says, oh, has anybody seen Carol? Doug's just called. So we know that he's calling around because he's obviously panicking, and he learned that the rig went back, you know, was back on time. So obviously he's been waiting and he's angry because she kind of doesn't, she didn't turn up, but she didn't even tell him or consider the fact that they were supposed to meet.
That was, and because there is that moment, isn't there, where she says, oh, that's right. And we know Doug must be like, are you serious?
Yeah,
I know.
Like, I think, although, I mean, I disagree with what Doug had planned.
Yeah.
I think he had at least every right to be annoyed, not so much about the kiss, but that he was completely stood up by the person who is supposed to think about him.
Yes, and I think that's it.
Yeah, and she comes in, and she doesn't say, I wasn't thinking about you, but she does say, you know, I was going through something, I was feeling something, I had to take some time, I had to, and he was just like, I was stood in a corner and I told you I was going to be there.
Yeah.
And you left me there.
Yeah.
And not only did she leave him there, but he obviously then went home, and she still, because she's been, it sounds like she was then walking around a lot. Just a phone call to say, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's why this storyline just frustrated me in so many ways, because I thought I could see why Doug had done wrong, but I could see why Carol had done wrong. And also I felt like it was putting a fake spanner in the works for no reason other than we need to prolong this, them two being together or whatever. So there you go. That, I mean, that's where it ends as well. We see Doug storm out, and we don't know what's in store next week for them. Stay tuned. You'll find out.
Indeed, tuned. So Doug and Carol was a heck of a chonky bit. So who do you want to talk about next?
I've missed Carter because...
Have you?
Of course, of course. Yeah.
Because it's been ages. It's been so long. And when I saw his face, I was like, I'm home. I'm home.
Aww.
Here he is, my favourite. But yeah, you can do whoever you want next.
I think we don't have any choice in the matter.
I think it would be safest for all if we just go with
that. Well, so this is an interesting moment. You know, they have this really interesting case. And this case, the first case, this Mr. Dwyer who comes in that both Carter and Anna look after, is a case, an image that has haunted me since I've seen this back in the 90s. So, you know, Carter and Anna are dealing with Mr. Dwyer, who has come back from traveling and he's not been well and nobody's been able to figure it out. But both of them have figured out that it's actually guinea worm. Is what it is, and they say, well, we have to extract it. So they go in, they find it, and then they extract 2 centimeters, and then they tape it down to a toothpick and say, come back tomorrow. And he says, what the hell, can't you just yank it out? And they say, sorry, we can't do that because it could break off. So and they can grow up to what? How many meters did they say?
I think he says 1 meter, but it's still
two centimeters at a time. Like, and it really show it, and I could just keep throwing up for the rest of my life. I have this weird, I just hate this idea of like things in, living inside, like parasites, or like, oh, it just makes me feel sick.
So you're not a big fan of the probiotic movement then?
No, well, no, that's they should be banned. No, it's like, little, worms and things, makes me feel so, I get itchy.
It reminds me of in the 80s when we had all those admittedly horrific and illuminating videos from Africa, from Ethiopia. And there was a lot of kids who had the worms inside them and stuff. And it makes me think about that as well.
Gosh, yeah.
That kind of extreme deprivation that these kids were living in.
I think for me as well, the idea that it'd be pulled out of you 2 centimeters at a time, so then you have to go home every day with a bit more of it out, and I can't deal
praying
with it.
It doesn't break.
Break, and it's skinniest little thing. So that's kind of where we start. While they're dealing with Mr. Dwyer, Chase turns up looking like crap, let's say. Dear. Doesn't he look not well?
And it's... So this storyline is very, very mixed. But what I did like a lot about his entrance is that he is not just a character who is going through heroin withdrawals. And, Anna sees him straight away for what is going on, as we find out later on. We find out why. But his arrival is like a great symbol for how addiction can just break into your life. And like, because Carter's just, I did not have look after my cousin going through withdrawals on my bingo card for today.
Exactly.
Because that's how this works. It doesn't care about your timetable. It doesn't care about what your plans were. And then later on in the episode as well, after he has been summarily told to get the F out of the ER, there's still message after message after message.
Yeah.
It's, and there is definitely this idea, or at least there's so many depictions of people struggling with both addiction and withdrawal, that they will pass a polygraph and tell you they're listening, and they will not hear a single word that you say.
Of course, because there's I've got somewhere to be. There's an A and there's a B. And if to get to B, I have to go through you or lie. That's what I thought was really fascinating about it. The fact that for him, after everything he knows, Carter knows about him, all that reason goes out the window, because you think, actually, my B point is I need to get something to feel better. I'll say whatever it takes, and I bet I'll be able to fool him, because I think you get into that world as well of thinking you're bigger and smarter than other people in some ways. And Carter's not fooled. He, as you say, kind of kicks him out of the ER. Anna walks over and says, I recognize this. I had a friend who went through the same thing when I was in college, and tries to warn him or just steer him and make sure that he's trying to be careful, which Carter doesn't take very well, which I also understand why, because when somebody you care about comes in, or somebody you love, it's that thing, isn't it? I can say what I want about my dad, but if you try and say something, I will get you.
Yeah.
It's like, don't don't tell me how to, you know, I don't, shame, embarrassment, all that stuff is mixed in.
Yes.
As you say, you know, Chase keeps calling, wanting this prescription. It gets to the point where Carter's obviously, it's too much. So he just says to Green, you know, I've got to go, family emergency. But before he leaves, you know, Anna's in the doctor's land watching him gather his stuff. And again, she says to him, she warns him again about the fact that, you know, be careful, these aren't easy ways, don't get sucked in, you know, just all these things. And again, Carter doesn't want to hear, and he kind of, he goes anywhere, and he goes straight to Chase, and Chase opens the door, and he's very, I mean, he looks a million times worse. You can see this, you know, he's sweating, and he's shaking, and he's, and but he opens the door, and there's that moment of like, oh, you, and Carter, you know, pushes in and stays with him and says, look, we, you know, we're going to help you. And he's, they argue and they fight. And it's a really interesting, and I thought, realistic portrayal of that kind of addict versus somebody trying to help, you know, that denial, that anger, that frustration, that you're in my way, I just want to get my thing. And then I don't know how you guys felt, but I thought it was a brilliant two-hander between these two fine actors.
Very fine actors.
Yeah, actually, props to Jonathan Scarfe, because it's not an easy role to play. You have to play manic, you have to play coming down, you have to play this, and it would be so easy to go into parody. And it was so easy to just do like, oh, well, I'll just be crawling the walls and, you know, kind of like
foaming at the mouth. And
you know, there's, it is a deeply unattractive depiction. And it's, I felt it's quite realistic. Now, I will, I will be completely honest and say, I don't have experience of dealing with somebody coming down from a strong drug like this. So I can't speak for how accurate it is as a portrayal, but as an audience member, I thought, yeah, I believe this. I believe this man is going through withdrawals, and I believe that he will promise the sun, moon, and stars to John if he just give him a little something. And the biggest victory, massive victory, is when he says no to the dealer.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's, well, the dealer obviously, you know, knocks on the door, Chase goes to the door, and you kind of realize that's what he'd been hoping Carter had been. And that's, and then there's that, there's that tension, because the dealer's like pushing Carter out the way and saying, this isn't about you. This guy's a grown man. He's called me. These are his, you know, I've got his order. And Carter's on the other side. It's like the, you know, bad angel, good angel kind of on the shoulders, and one saying, take the drugs, and the other one's going, don't. But Carter says, look, don't. I can, you know, I can help you. I can, we can do something together. We can sort this out. And Chase does shut the door on the dealer, which I, you know, I thought, wow, okay. Again, it could be another, you know, I'm going to play this rule, shut the door for now, to play the rule to hopefully maybe get rid of you. But also it could be a, actually, I've got this support here. Maybe I can kick this. Because he had made the decision to come off the drugs, hadn't he? He said,
he did that on his own, didn't he?
Yeah. He said, look, I've 2 days, I haven't had any, like I'm trying to come off it. So there is a will there somewhere.
Yeah. So I suppose, I mean, they always say, like, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But if you don't have the willpower and all of the help and everything in the world, we'll get yourself, you might get over this withdrawal symptom. Sure. If you're locked in a room and you can't take something, then sure, you will go through a horrific withdrawal and it will be awful and you'll come out the other side of it. But if the willpower isn't there, you just wait for it to pass and go straight back and find your dealer again.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have to want to get better and recognize it's a problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, they always say you've got to say what it is. You have to say it's a problem before you can kind of deal with it. And it's, you know, and Carter manages to calm him down and manages, you know, because he's been very angry and shouty and throwy things, and he calms him down. And then he's actually on the phone to the pharmacy trying to see if the prescriptions come through, and they don't seem to know what he's talking about. The door knocks and it's Anna. And this is what's really, this is a lovely moment, because she's recognized it. She's seen it. And she's, yes, she had a moment where she was trying to help John. She realized that's not the way to do it. But she turns up because she knows how hard it can be. And she knows having an extra person will just, and an extra person that Chase knows, he knows Anna a bit. He is, and this isn't another face just coming in. It's somebody who can help? So she comes, which I think is a real comfort, and she's brought the medication and she has some experience. So she's like, you prescribed a lot less than what he's going to actually need. So it felt like, yeah, here comes some expertise. And it also allows for a moment later when Chase is asleep, for Anna and Carter to kind of have a little heart to heart. And Carter says that he's just, what he can't kind of comprehend is why this talented cousin of his, who's got the world at his feet, is abusing drugs. And you know, his pictures are hanging around, and we all know, you know, he's got a great job, and it sounds like he's got everything in the world, and yet, you know, he's throwing it away or whatever. And Anna kind of says, you know, that's addiction. That's what happens. It can happen to anybody. Again, I thought that was why this was also a really important storyline, because we get a lot of drugs in the poor places, drug dealers in the poor, and it's like, hang on a minute, it also happens here, and we get to see how it happens there, and this kind of very, you know, cleaned up, preppy looking guy turns up and he's the dealer.
I was gonna say, he's playing squash.
You know,
and the fact that Carter walks in and says, oh, it smells like a locker room here, has the maid not been by? And he's not saying that as a joke, like Chase literally has a maid to come around and clean up after him.
Yeah.
And they mentioned about, oh, I guess you can go to the company nurse to get some Compazine. Company nurse? What?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It is just another world that they live in.
Absolutely. But this will still break through. And at the end of the day, it will hit you the same way it hits that person over there. It's just you might have better resources. And that's when kind of Anna comes clean and says, look, it was my boyfriend. And I know how hard it is with addiction when you love somebody. And I think it's a really nice moment for Carter to know that there's somebody who gets it and somebody who's been there and maybe been burnt by it a few times as well. Because that's the sense you get from Anna, that she tried and she's given a million speeches and she's been here. But she's not like that with him when she comes to the apartment. She's very much like, I get it. I've been there, very, very vulnerable, and they're both kind of vulnerable together. And I thought it was a great moment, because we got to learn more about Chase. You know, we didn't know he was a photographer, and he was a talented photographer. We got to kind of see his apartment, see his life a little bit, and then we got this little bit of Anna as well. You know, talking about her past and her history, and I thought it was really nice little.
I think this is it brings home to me why we were robbed by not having more Anna, whatever the reason was, because she's such a great character and there's lots to explore there, and her experience with drug dependency. And I know we get some of it later in the season, spoilers, but I don't know. I still want, because she's such a good character and so well acted. And it's like, I want more.
That's what it is. She is the kind, she's so talented an actress that she could deal with a lot. Whatever you kind of throw at her, you know, when Abby turns up, she's very similar. She's such a brilliant actress. She can kind of deal with whatever they throw at her, and you enjoy watching her. And I think that's what Maria Bello's got as well. She's just enjoyable to watch. So I agree with you. So that's kind of where that lean like ends up, you know, that story. And I just thought it was a nice. It was just a sweet little, this is, I don't mind going away from the ER when you're learning and learning about other stuff. It just felt, don't know. I felt like I was missing all of them together. Cause as I said, you know, they're all separate, but that's Carter and Anna's story this week.
So how about we go to the cutest couple that have yet to start up, Benton and Corday.
How lovely was that this week?
So we've got to talk about Romano as well, unfortunately.
Well, you've got to take the bitter with the sweet, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's swallow the Romano pill first, and then we'll...
Yeah. Great. So we see him when Jeannie comes up to surgery to advise that she's been asked to do Scotty's lines. And Romano comes out with, no, I don't mind, you start more lines with sugar. And it's just like...
Oh, I know. He just objectifies any woman that walks by, gets reduced down to their sexuality. There's just nothing else but him about women, it seems. And it's really annoying.
It's the cynical thing of, oh, you've come up from the ER to help out. I guess everybody wants to suck up to Anspar. It's like, you've got her 100% wrong.
Exactly.
Completely and utterly. And you know as well that he doesn't care.
Yes.
Like, you know, yeah. he's just like, exactly. And oh, he's just a, and you can see how he has written off Lizzie.
Yes.
And it's all because she's basically rejected him. That's what it is. Yeah, yeah. He comes across as so petty, you know. He finds out she says to him, look, I can't be in the Anspar surgery. I'm going to sit with Koklovitz while he does Alison's surgery.
Yeah.
And he really petty, like a little kid, says, well, you weren't on it anyway. Yeah. She's like, I saw my name on the board.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, God, you're such a child. And it is literally because he's got a bruised ego because she isn't fawning after him. She's gone and got this other surgeon. She's now going to watch this other surgeon. And he just can't handle it. And he's just, ridiculous. He just starts being nasty. I mean it's brilliant because so he's obviously him and Benton are then in the surgery for Scott Anspar, and he's really trying to do Corday down.
Oh, he's been horrible, absolutely horrible.
He's just like, oh, you know, this is what happens with female surgeons, you know, they're just trying to prove themselves. And it, again, really reduces somebody down to one identity and identifier about them.
One of the things I love about Benton is that there's not even, because Benton is, as we know, he is Mr. Career. He is, you know, kind of, and has been quite savage in how he will do anything to get ahead. And in a way, he is being offered a kind of a horrible stepladder, you know, to move ahead, get in with Romano. Well, we'll just slag her off. And, you know, if I'm in with Romano, da-da. He's just like, that's not been my experience. I have never found that with female surgeons. And I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, which again, despite the fact that he would, you know, he will be very, very blunt about getting forward, that is also classic Peter. Like,
yeah, his integrity, isn't it?
Yeah. He is. In a way that is brilliant and also dreadful for his career, he has no tact. He will tell you exactly what he is thinking and what he is reacting to what you're saying.
Yeah, he won't finesse or try and play the game or try and not outright say, no, you're wrong. You know, there are other ways he could have kind of, oh, yeah, maybe. I haven't found that, but yes, maybe.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, but he doesn't. He very much sticks up for it. But that's him. He's Mr. Integrity. He would never want, if he's going to get somewhere, he wants to get there the right way. He doesn't want to, he's not Edson. If that had been Edson, he would have been
So and I've heard Corday does this and I've heard Corday does that.
Yeah, here's some misogynistic jokes that we can laugh at.
Did you hear about the time Corday walked into a bar? Shut up, Edson.
Yeah. So we get that. And then Romano does and says something that gets me very angry. And this is something, again, I think most people of colour have had experience of. You get, oh, that race is bad, but you're okay because you do this. Or so he gets told, oh, you know, what I like about you, Peter, is you're not a militant minority. Now, that made this minority get very militant because I was like...
Because I remember we spoke before, Paul McCrane was really hesitant about taking on the role of Romano initially because he's like, I'm going to be such a villain. I'm going to be hated. And Paul McCrane, who I'm sure is a lovely human being, I really hope that's an accurate statement that is not going to age badly.
Next week.
Actually, I don't know if you saw on the news today.
Like, you know, about all of the people he's killed. Again, really hope that statement doesn't age badly. Romano is such an odious character that it's really hard not to be like, I see a picture of Paul McCrane and be like,
Yeah.
Moments like this, you're like, in the writing of that, how do you go, he will say this and everyone in the room isn't going to turn around and go like, you're an absolute arse, you know this, right?
Yes.
And you kind of have to have that air of, I do not care.
Yeah, and even if you did.
He plays it so horribly well.
Yeah, you believe it. You completely. Mm-hmm. And Benton just has that look on his face like, because obviously this is something he's probably been through as well a few times.
Yeah.
And then when they find out that obviously Scotty's lymphoma is back, he just says to Benton, well, I don't want to tell Anspar. Off you go. You go tell him, like,
no.
You do my bidding, which, again, just, he's just hideous.
He's just awful.
Yeah.
And he is, I think we've spoken about this before, he is just the almost, he's certainly the poster child of the uncaring surgeon.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, say, even Count V was more human than he is.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
about.
Yeah, he's very much like, if you would speak to different surgeons, you know, you might get to, like, why did you want to be a, like, you speak to Benton, why do you want to be a surgeon? He might say, like, I want to help people, and someone else will say, well, actually, the techniques, or, and you can imagine Romano just being like, I want that godlike power to, you know, kill somebody, have a life in my hand, and I can decide how it goes, which is what makes him so brilliant in this, and must be great for every all the other characters to play off. He obviously, you know, that Benton has to go and talk to Anspar, and then obviously Benton's exhausted and tired, and meanwhile Corday has gone into the Koklovitz with Alison, the Koklovitz surgery. And I think this is also what rubs Romano up the wrong way in some ways, because he says to her, you're just going to, like, oh, you want to go and help out with the flashy kind of surgery, and she says, no, I'm there for Alison. And we see her go in as well, and he, I think, doesn't recognize this idea of being there for your patient. He's like, well, no, what is it you're gonna get out of this? And then, you know, so she's there, and it's so sweet, because she's seen, and she's the one who's fought for Alison to get her voice back, and she's the one who's been with her, and she says to Koklovitz, I'm here just for Alison. And you can see Alison being like, you know, this is so great to have this person, you know, Alison hasn't got anybody in the world. And we're there when she finally gets her voice back, and the first thing she says is thank you to Corday, which is
so heartwarming.
So sweet. And so she's, I guess maybe Corday's on a little bit of a high, but she sees Peter at the lifts, and she says, let's go for a drink. And they have a bit of a conversation, because he's like, I don't drink. And she says, well, you've got to drink something at some point.
You're 60% water, Ben. Yeah.
and she gets him to go out with him, which I don't think is an easy thing to do. I don't think a lot of people could do that, but she can, because she's magic. And then they go to what seems like a British pub. It just seems like
it's
very
a theme pub, doesn't it?
Yeah, which
it,
I thought was
very,
like,
yeah, I was like, all right, okay,
that's
yes,
what we
of course
do.
Corday would find the one British pub, and this is where she's bringing Benton.
It felt very much Americans writing for British people.
Yeah.
You'll go to a pub and you'll have some tea, and then you'll, you know,
everyone plays darts.
Yeah.
I don't buy that she's been playing. I don't buy that she's been playing darts since she's a kid. And that's, I know that's actually a classist thing to say.
No, but I agree with you. I was about to say the same. It's not really a thing that people of her class would grow up around.
Don't grow up in the pub like people of maybe more work. And I'm saying this as a working class person.
Yeah.
Like the pub was the central hub of our village, but I don't imagine Corday's, especially as we meet Corday's dad and mum later on. I don't see them going to a pub.
They would play billiards or, like, you know, or card games. I don't imagine them playing darts. That felt a bit anachronistic of whatever.
Yeah.
That felt wrong.
What I thought as well, but in a way, it's a weirdly important episode for what we discover. Like, because Corday is brilliant in how she will just ask a question. Like Benton, she doesn't have a filter. She has more of a filter than Benton does. She knows how to read a room a little bit better than Benton does. But she manages to turn around and says, oh, are you an alcoholic, by the way?
Yeah, the way she
finally
just will
answering
ask
the question, why don't you drink?
Yeah.
Because we know Peter doesn't drink, and we know that he's a vegetarian. She's like, I just don't like the flavour.
And then she says, oh, are you Muslim? Because you don't eat pork. He's like, no.
Yeah. And I really liked, well, I like her directness. It does annoy me sometimes. I mean, I'm glad she asked the question, because I don't drink, and I often get, oh, are you, the first thing I get is, are you Muslim? Because I'm brown, so people can't think past that. It'd be my own choice. I'm not allowed to have an adult human choice. Mm. And so I like that she's direct, but I felt a bit like, oh God, why did you have to go straight to kind of, I don't know, she don't eat pork. And I was just like, I'm sure you've seen him not eat other meats. Why did the pork? Like, I would have maybe just said, what, are you vegetarian? And maybe not ask somebody if they're an alcoholic, because if they are, that's also a bit, that's not going to be a fun story for everybody to be telling if that is something. I don't know. Anyway, she's very direct and she's very charming with it. So it works. And I think Peter quite enjoys that she's direct. I think he likes that she doesn't really play games and she kind of just says it.
Yeah.
And it disarms him in some ways because he's very honest with her about stuff. And, you know, because I feel like Carter may have mentioned something to him before and he never answered why he doesn't eat meat or there was something. But with her, he'll tell her because of the way she kind of... she is with him. I'm going to say a sentence now that I never thought I would ever say, and that darts
here we go.
Is sexy. She made darts sexy.
She did make darts sexy.
Who would have thought?
It's Alex Kingston. That's she can make anything.
Well, that's true. I believe that was Alex Kingston actually made that shot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the one where she's doing it backwards.
Backwards, eyes closed.
Backwards from another room. Yeah.
I reckon it took two takes. The first take, somebody got a dart in the eye, and the second one, bullseye. You know? Because, you know, and I reckon she meant both of them.
I do too. That person said something really mean to her in the earlier in the day, and she has great aim. It felt very reminiscent of the scene in Prince of Thieves where she blows in his ear the archery, you know, when they're having a competition and Maid Marian blows in I was waiting for her to blow in Benton's ear because I was like, because she gets so close, like she's proper manhandling him, like getting his stance, you know, hands on thighs, it's all very sexual, and I was just waiting for her to say something very sexy in his, I just thought that's what was missing from it, but you know, she didn't. She played fair. So they decide to play so that he will try some pims. You know, if she gets the bullseye, he has to try pims. If she doesn't, he doesn't have to. And she's going to make it fair. She's going to do it backwards and eyes closed, all that kind of stuff. And she still manages to get the bullseye, so he does have pims, and she gets him drunk.
On two pims. I mean, two pims isn't strong, is it?
No, it isn't. But if you don't drink, ever,
it's enough.
It must, yeah.
Is this the first time he's got drunk?
Yeah, we haven't certainly seen him drunk before, have we?
We've never seen him drunk. I don't remember him telling a story of, I was drunk when I was a kid or anything. So quite possibly is.
Ah. And their dancing is, they really
dirty grind dancing.
I'm like, they're clearly like, they're going to bone.
There's a lot in that, isn't there? It's such a sex. And this is what I mean about these two. They sizzle for me. In the hands of two other actors, it might not have been half as sexy as it turned out with these two. I just think there's something about their chemistry that is just red hot. And I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Now, I'm just going to mention it now, but it's something that we'll talk about as the season goes on. The behind the scenes stuff with Corday and Benton is very interesting.
It is. Oh, okay. It's true.
Yeah. Well, I think we might leave that for a little bit later on down the season because spoilers and all that, but it's very, very interesting.
And then we think they're going to end up together, you know, go home together possibly, but no, you know, she's not going to take advantage of him. She puts him in a taxi and she gets her own taxi and they part ways, but you know, it's been a long time since we've seen Peter smile with a woman. You know, we've seen him soften with Reese, and that's all been very sweet. But this is just another. We never really saw him. Yeah, he would flirt with Carla and things, but I don't know. This just felt a lot sexier and a lot more like seduction and long seduction type tactics. So that's a nice little firecracker going off in the middle of this. So what have we gotten left?
Benton and Corday were both wearing dark polo necks, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And so was Doug.
The Doug dark polo neck was very milk tray.
Was that the thing back then?
Oh, potential. Well, I suppose actually, 90s kind of.
Yeah.
That does kind of fit. And the kind of the grey trousers that were always a little bit too big. And trench coats. Everyone in trench coats.
Yes.
For a hot minute. No, you will not hear me complaining. Doug looked bloody amazing in his polo neck. And so did Benton. I thought he looked quite young this episode. Something about the style.
Because he's smiling. That's why. He's smiling.
It was very strange.
He's light. Do you know what I mean? It's taking
I wonder, did Eric LaSalle have to do some sort of boot camp in preparation for this episode? Because it had been so long
since forgotten.
Lift the corners of your mouth, Benton.
I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know the way we're all smiling and really happy? So Scott Anspaugh.
Yeah.
Bloody hell. I know. Yeah.
I mean, it's hideous, but it's a beautiful genie. This is a beautiful genie episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Scott is basically, they're going to have to do surgery on him to find out what's going on. And he's scared of the surgery, and he kind of, you know, we see that him and Genie have got a good relationship. And she says to him, look, if you go through with this, I will get you these tickets to the Blackhawks ice hockey, which are, you know, mad tickets, but she promises that she will get, you know, that she has them, which helps him actually go and have the surgery, which is really...
Because initially he's a bit like, I've done all this before, I'm not doing this again.
I'm over it, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, which is both that.
Ready to die, he says.
And it's whenever you see a child character saying those words, you're like, everything about that, well, I mean, depending on the situation, anytime somebody says, I'm ready to die, you're kind of like, oh, I find it quite difficult to accept that. But of course, there's many, many different situations. Da, 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 da. But particularly when a kid says it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah. And I think, yes, I think he's really tired, but I also think he's scared. And I think that's what Genie taps into. And that's why she knows that it's not all about him just being exhausted by it, it's fear, and it's important that she finds ways to get through that. And she's the only one. And what I love is how she comes in at the beginning, he's playing his computer game, and she kind of comes and says, I want to talk about your surgery. And she really talks to him like he's an adult, and I don't imagine or any of the other doctors do that. And she really says, let's talk about surgery, let's talk about things, and it makes him, I think, feel like a proper human, which I think is what a big kind of part of why he likes her.
Listen to his concerns, as opposed to even, you'd be totally understand if everyone, in particularly in this ER, but everywhere else, listened to Donald Anspaugh. And what does Donald want to do? You know, what's, you know, as opposed to Scott. And she's like, I mean, yes, of course, I will speak to your dad. I mean, it's very, very important. He is also going through a journey, but you are the one who will have to go through treatment. You are the one who will have to have surgery. You know, so I need to know, what is your headspace at the moment?
And in the same way of kind of the addict having to get to a point where they go, right, I'm ready for help. I think when you're sick, I think it's the same. You need to be at a point where you want to fight, and you want to see through everything. It helps you to get through all the horrible stuff you end up having to go through, I think. And then we find out his lymphoma's back, which is really, really horrible. And we have that scene where Benton tells Anspaugh, and Anspaugh just goes straight back to work.
He just pivots and goes straight back to...
Yeah, which I thought was completely one of those, that's his character, isn't it? I can't deal with this. Work. Bury himself in work.
Compartmentalize. What can I handle right now? I can handle what Kerry is saying to me. I cannot handle the fact that my son now has to undergo treatment again for cancer as a teenager. And it's heartbreakingly blunt.
Yeah.
You know? It obviously does affect him. I mean, of course it affects him, but it affects him to the point where he looks the most lost I think we've ever seen Anspaugh look.
Yeah.
As he approaches Genie at the end.
Yeah. And it's great, because I don't mean great. There are a couple of really beautiful moments in this whole storyline. There's a moment where Anspaugh comes over to Genie and he tells her about Scott and says, you know, and he asks her to come on board as kind of a part-time caregiver, because Scott really responds to her. Yeah. And he says, you know, Scott thinks highly of you. So do I. Which is lovely. After everything they've been through and how hard we see him, this is beautiful, because Genie has just been herself, and he's seen that and gone, I love her for that, you know.
Yeah.
And she's obviously also bringing so much comfort to, and being somebody who can get in, because Anspaugh, we can see, can't communicate with Scotty, but he's got Genie, who is there, can make Scotty do things he wouldn't have done otherwise. And you know, and then the second bit that I think is just Oh, it's heartbreaking, but it's so beautifully shot and beautifully lit, is when at the end, Jeannie goes to sit with Scott and show him that she's got the tickets, which she got from Malik, which really cute friendship we were talking about.
Really, really nice.
Yeah, she asks him to hook her up, score of these tickets. He's like, okay, I can do it, but they're going to be expensive. And she says it doesn't matter. And he comes through, she's got the tickets, and she goes to show Scotty, and then she's like, you know, they talk a bit about the fact, you know, his lymphoma's back, blah, blah, blah. And then he says to her, he says, can you stay? It gets a bit creepy at night. Now, this is Mr., you know, Scotty Anspaugh, who came in all angry and defensive and acts so brave and big and I don't give a crap. And I thought that moment where he says it's a bit scary. First, it's the first time I saw him as a little kid properly, because he showed that vulnerability. But it shows how comfortable he is with Jeannie, because I don't think he'd be able to say that to anybody else.
And certainly not his dad.
Yeah.
I get, and I think this is, I assume it's deliberate in, you know, John Aylward, obviously, you know, you can have a son at any point of your life, but it seems like there's oceans of generations between him and Scotty.
Yeah.
That it's not just father and son. I would believe you if you told me it was grandfather, grandson.
Not to say that
John Aylward himself is such an old man at this, it's not even, but it's the way they conduct each other. He is everything kind of proper and business and doctor and everything. And Scotty's there playing a Nintendo in the ER.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think as well is, I get this, you know, you really get a sense that Anspaugh is of that generation of man works, doesn't deal with kids. Kids get raised. I will pat your head on your birthday. I will, you know, I'm not going to really interact or be that part of you. And also that, I think, you know, we hear he lost his wife before, and you imagine maybe she probably played that role. And now he's like, oh God, I've got to learn who my kids are, and what they are, who are these, you know. And I think that absolutely, you know, he just seems very 1950s rigid. I go to work in the morning, I come home, food's on the table.
Smokes his pipe in the lounge while wife makes the
pours him a whiskey and makes the dinner, you know. And so that scene where Scotty says to why have her name gone, Jeannie, will you sit with me? It was so beautifully lit, because it's really delicate on both Jeannie and on Scotty in this kind of dark room. And then on the outside, you see Anspaugh looking in from a very well-lit area, and he's watching over. And then Jeannie just turns to him and she smiles to say, you know, I'm here and I've got this. And then turns back, and he really is on the outside, and they look warm and he looks very cold. And I just thought it was just beautifully directed and shot, that moment for me, I thought.
I love the, like you say, the thing of Anspaugh literally behind a pane of glass, and metaphorically, do you know what I mean? He can't connect physically or emotionally with him. It's just a nice little neat.
And choosing not to go in, you know, like not being next to them both, watching her take that role. So we've kind of progressed that storyline on, and it's very sweet. I guess Weaver's the last. Oh no, Mark as well. Mark's got bits in here, hasn't he?
He does. Actually, I tell you what, maybe we'll go for Mark, because I think he has the smallest role nearly in the episode. He's there, you know. He does things, but
he's more in service of other people's things, you know. Well, we find out he's smoking again, because, you know, when Doug goes to meet him, they're having to sit in the smoking section. He's like, yeah, I'm smoking again. And you're
smoking,
like,
smoking sections, bloody hell.
And I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, my mid-20s, and I don't know what anything is that you're saying.
Of course,
oh, and so he's there, so we know that what they're doing there is hinting that something's not right for him to have gone back to smoking. Something's not going right in his life. Later we see kind of, you know, Cynthia runs over and she says to him, oh, you owe me money, I can tell you've smoked. And then she says, let's make s'mores, which I thought, gosh, it really is making her seem very young compared to him. I want to make s'mores, you know, like she's 15, you know. I thought it really highlighted that gulf between them, and he's very serious and she's like, let's make s'mores. flowers and give me money. And so I don't know if they, it was hinting again at that's not really right. And then we have him shouting at the policeman because he's he says when the elder lady comes in and she dies, he says, I haven't seen this on the news. I feel like you need to be telling people, warning people that this is happening. You're too different. You know, police people, they say, well, it's a different jurisdiction. So it means that obviously this person is moving around quite a bit. So he gets quite angry. So we still get that flare up again of his past feelings, but also just of safety for people. Because it is weird that they're not telling anybody, because people might be a bit more vigilant with their elder, you know, family members and stuff, and they might add more security or maybe move them somewhere. It seems, I don't particularly understand why you wouldn't say there's some, you know, there's a serial something out there. I don't know if that is a done thing. I always feel like, you know, when...
That's a good point. Actually, I don't, like, I mean, I get it that, like, that you can't release the details of ongoing cases. Sure. But you can give people a heads up, surely. Yeah. Now, actually, out of interest, if anyone listening to this works in law enforcement and has any experience of this, like, legit, I wonder, like, what are the restrictions that you have to work with? Because maybe me going, well, could you not put something out the paper? No, maybe it can do as much harm as good.
Yeah, yeah, there might be implications. I just don't. Well, yeah, it's weird.
From my knowledge of serial killers, which however I couch that wouldn't sound good, you don't tend to find out about them until near the end. Do you know what I mean? And there's that sort of potentially apocryphal idea that at any given time there are some, like, it's something stupid like 57 drug dealers active in America or something like that, but you don't know about it until they're caught. And I think that might be to avoid them being glamorized, because definitely not, you know, serial rapists won't be glamorized, but serial killers definitely are. Look at Richard Ramirez. Do you know what I mean? He was a rock star.
Well, then you get, but then you do get, like, Peter Sutcliffe, that was known about the Yorkshire Ripper before he was caught, because there was that other guy who was terrorizing the police and saying, you haven't caught me yet. And I remember my mom saying, oh, you know, we were all scared at the time that was happening. She didn't live in Yorkshire, but, you know, it was on news. So it was a bit like, oh gosh. And I remember when that one in Suffolk was killing women. That was being reported. And that again felt very, oh my God, it could happen at any point and it's anywhere. And
that's true. And there's a few others that I can think of who
terrorized the police.
Yeah. Really. There was that, that guy, that sniper who's operating around Washington DC. But then again, you don't want to glamorize, and also you don't encourage copycat situations, which are a thing as well.
I feel like it's not like you would stand on the news and you go, right, this woman of this address at this time, you'd say, in these areas we've had a number of there's a thing of elderly women. And I've seen police reports where they have said, you know, we're a bit worried about, and you have to be a bit extra careful. So I don't know if it was more of a, what's the word? I mean, I don't know what it's like in America, but maybe it was, that is what it's like there, or maybe it's just that what they used to as a drama point rather than it being a realistic thing. I don't know. But that's kind of Mark in this episode. That's like literally all he does. He kind of talks to Doug, has that moment with, has that moment with Cynthia, has that moment with the police, picks up the phone to Doug and says Doug's looking for Carol. And then he's out. So should we turn to Weaver?
Weaver and Alice is waking up, isn't she?
She is waking up, finally.
Yeah, everything was perfect until she actually looked at
did some basic research of her own.
I mean, it all starts when a lady is brought in who's suffered an ectopic pregnancy, and she's coming from a whole other part of Chicago, and Weaver's like, why have you brought her here? She's been in the, you know, the ambulance longer, and they say, oh, that, you know, whatever trauma center is closed down at the moment. And it gets her feeling a bit like, oh, that's strange, why is that? And that's when she starts researching. And she, well, and I also, I think she researched because she tries to ask Ellis about it. He's very, he doesn't answer her the first time. He's very much like, oh, you know, we do these things. And I think that's why she then goes digging and.
Yeah. Basically, as she says herself, he turns around and goes, stats.
Yeah. But not even stats that you're asking about, just stats.
Yeah.
You know, it felt very politician-y. We are keeping as many things open as we can. You know, it's like, well, that's not answering any questions. You're not really saying anything.
Yeah.
So you are closing things down then, but we're keeping this open and keeping this like.
Yeah.
Mm. And in an excellent way, Kerry is just like, yeah, I'm going to stop you there because this is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you're saying. And, you know, I need to see numbers. And he kind of. You know, this plays on her throughout the episode. She starts to go, well, hang on, that's the. And they're kind of, you know, she asks Anspaw at one point, can we, you know, kind of delay the board meeting? And he's kind of like, but this was your idea.
Yeah.
You pushed for this. So in a way, even though she's coming around and she's doing her reading and everything, she runs the serious risk of having egg on her face.
Yeah,
because she has invited Synergex into the building, basically, and it's a bit like
when you invite the head vampire or just a vampire into your house.
Well, it's a bit like that kind of. It's a bit hard to uninvite them.
Yeah, you can't.
Oh, I could so imagine burn some sage. Him as Dracula now. Do you know what I mean?
Honestly,
that deep voice.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if Clancy Brown hasn't at some point in his life played a version of Dracula because he's got the perfect voice. Yeah. And he seems I realize I'm kind of skipping to the end a little bit.
No, but do it.
He That's seems cool. In their final confrontation, like he's being somewhat real with her. Like, and he's being blunt.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Sorry, that was a sneeze. So it was a somewhat kind of, oh, well, Kerry, like open your eyes, basically. And she's like, but what are you talking about? And he says a line that I didn't necessarily disagree with the logic. Was we don't send the Bentley, you know, we send the Oldsmobile. I'm sorry now if that doesn't mean someone's going to get the, you know, the most, you know, plush trip to the hospital. And Kerry's point is, no, but what you're making such a sweeping change is that everyone suddenly gets a lower standard of care. Mm. And I think they both have a valid point now. I think Kerry's obviously much more on Kerry's side here. She's like, oh, hang on. You know, this is already, you know, the ER is being held together with prayer and scotch tape. How much more can we, you know, can we stand to lose?
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'm thinking of this nationwide. I'm not thinking of this particular building. And they both have a point in that moment. Now, there's more coming. But in that moment, I think there is a valid point on both sides.
I think what frustrates me is this is what happens with these kind of in outhouse management or sometimes with management. It's this sense of they're just looking at money rather than realities of what it is going on, you know, like Kerry says to him, well, if you close all of those down, everything will end up coming here and then we'll be giving substandard care. And it just hasn't occurred to them because they're so busy going, well, the provision will be here without realizing, well, you can't send everybody there. There is a reason why these things are out there. And and I mean, she says to him, she does accuse him. She says, you know, I think you're putting profits before patients, which is, again, something I also feel. But they do this really interesting thing with Ellis in this episode where one time when she comes up to talk to him, he's schmoozing these people for lunch. And it really shows that kind of money, you know, that really dirty kind of money side of things. And it's all about these people get swish lunches and that. But, you know, this poor lady almost bled to death from an ectopic pregnancy because you've closed that ER down. You know, so they put that in there as well. And I mean, by the end that he's saying, is there anything I can do to make you feel better? And she just says, no, you know, you can delay the vote. You cannot. She wants more time because she is now starting to see what it really is and the practicalities of what it is that they were actually talking about. And this is why I feel a bit shocked with Kerry, because this is what Green was telling her, but she didn't want to see because she obviously saw just Ellis. And it was a bit like, I think she was blinded by him. And I always think of Kerry as somebody a lot more switched on and quite like, hang on, I'm going to kick the tires on this before I commit to it rather than yes, let's iron away everything before I've actually looked practically at what this means. So I think she was really kind of taken by him, which, yeah, I was like, come on, Kerry, wake up quicker.
She has a great line. I can't be part of an organisation that lowballs people's lives.
Yeah. Well, you don't come to work for the ER if you're a money.
But that's person, it. Like, if you're, you know, if like if you care about stats and accountancy, grand. I mean, the ER, which is, as we've talked many times, probably the busiest section of any hospital, because this is where the emergencies come. I mean, you need to have a passion for healthcare.
Yeah.
To make it in there, and we've seen people not make it in there because they don't have that passion.
Yeah.
But Kerry does, and she just also happens to have a great passion for admin, you know.
She loves which it. Is her favorite.
You know, kind of, you know, she's the one who, she'll nip home, she'll boil the kettle, and she'll write a 300-page thesis of an evening, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's all unraveling, really, isn't it? And I think she obviously feels very guilty because she kind of let the wolves in, and now she's like, oh, hang on, all that. Chicks are gone from the hen house kind of thing. So yeah, again, you know, that's also then teed up to play out. And that's the episode.
Yeah,
it is the episode. So I enjoyed, there's some, as you say, there's some good points in this, but it is a bit of a bitty kind of episode, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So we get a lot of different threads, directions, variants. And it's a bit like, couldn't tell you what the episode was about. Plenty of stuff happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's exactly it.
So we've got a couple of EHBI ERs.
Iber. Yep.
It's been so long.
Yeah.
Sean, do you want to go with the first one?
Connor Trinneer.
Yay!
So basically, this is Star Trek does ER, this episode anyway, which is great, obviously, for us. But particularly, yeah, so one of the paramedics coming in from the other, the closed, ER is played by Connor Trinneer, who was we would have first met him through Star Trek Enterprise. He played Trip Tucker, but he also appeared as Michael the Wraith in Stargate Atlantis. He was Professor Langston, can't remember the pronunciation now, in Stargate Origins.
He kind of came out.
It was, yes, he was Catherine Lang. I'm going to say Langston, and I am sure I will be told in the comments. and yeah, he's been in plenty of things that way. But yes, we would most know him from particularly Star Trek and then Stargate after that.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, he did so much as Trip that, you know, he is. Yeah. We've also got Paul Shearer, who plays the drug dealer, unnamed drug dealer, who's been in lots of things, but I recognised him. I thought he played one person in Star Trek, but it was actually someone else, I realised, who was Voji in an episode called Critical Care of Star Trek Voyage, which ironically enough is about classism and medical treatment.
Yep.
But yeah, it's he's very sort of recognisable. And we've also got Eric Pierpoint.
Yes, he's played multiple roles in Trek, but there was, I'm not sure if you remember, season 5, not Blaze of Glory, For the Uniform, I think. And it's where Sisko is hunting Michael Eddington.
Oh, okay.
And the Excelsior class ship, the Malinche, captained by Captain Eric Pierpoint.
Oh, okay.
So he's out of no alien makeup or anything on that episode. He's just in a uniform looking pretty cool, I have to say. And I know he turns up in other roles as well, but that was the first one that came to mind for me.
He was also, bring it back to non-Star Trek, he was the chief of police in Parks and Recreation, Chief Hugh Trumple.
Oh.
Who makes...
Great name.
Great name, yeah. Who makes Ben Wyatt very, very nervous. Well, every cop makes Ben Wyatt nervous. But
yes, they do. But he plays a big part in that. Yeah.
He's like, is there something wrong with you, son? Because Ben is just squirming. But so that's...
Because he's a human disaster, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I love Ben Wyatt.
he's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. He's sort of ideal husband material, practically.
Mm.
But so that's my Ibers. Anyone else?
Nope.
So I wanted to talk about our disease in focus. I've got to think of a better name because that just sounds horrible. which is the guinea worm, which was pulled out of Eric Pierpont's character's leg. We talked about it a little bit before. It's actually, as I mentioned, it's Dracunculus medinensis.
Whoa.
Which, yeah, it's a mouthful. So that Dracunculus basically means little dragon. Well, the whole name means little dragon from Medina.
Oh, wow.
Draco, yeah. And it's described in Egypt as early as the 15th century BC, and possibly was the fiery serpent of the Israelites described in the Bible. So basically, wow. Yeah, I know. So basically, it gets into other animals by infecting microcrustaceans in dirty water. The mammal drinks the water,
yeah,
and then the digestion destroys the microcrustaceans and leaves the worms to go off and do their thing, the thing that birds and bees do. Mm-hmm. And then the male dies and the female swims down somewhere else and creates that blister, so that whenever somebody goes into water to soothe the blister, the eggs are released, the larvae, I think, are released. But yeah,
I'm with you. No, thank you.
Yeah.
It can grow up to 80 centimeters long, the female. It's among the longest nematodes that can infect humans. but it's a disease that is potentially going to be completely eradicated. Because we're understanding it better, and water is being treated properly and things like that. So,
excellent.
So yeah. So that is the guinea worm. Let's talk about something else so we don't leave our listeners on something to vomit about. anybody?
I thought Carter looked really pretty this episode.
He did look very handsome.
And that's what got me through the guinea fowl thing.
Yeah,
that's what I'm calling it, because it's guinea and foul.
yeah,
and he did get friend zoned epically by Anna. He had a little moment.
We're good.
Oh, you're okay
with that. That's how it should be forever. Everybody friend zone Carter, please. Thank you.
Okay, and on that note, we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget, you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and remember, you set the tone.